You are listening to Subjected. I am your host, Justin Kerfman. Episode 2, Georg Trockel.
De Profundis. Es ist ein Stoppelfeld, in das ein schwarzer Regen fällt. Es ist ein brauner Baum, der einsam da steht. Es ist ein Zwischelwind, der leere Hütten umkreist, wie traurig dieser Abend. Am Weiler vorbei sammelt die sanfte Weise noch spärliche Ehren ein. Ihre Augen weiden rund und goldig in der Dämmerung, und ihr Schoß hart des himmlischen Bräutigams. Bei der Heimkehr fanden die Herden den süßen Leib, wer wärst im Dornenbusch. Ein Schatten bin ich ferne finsteren Dörfen, Gottes Schweigen trank ich aus dem Brunnen des Hains. Auf meine Sterne tritt kaltes Metall, Spinnen suchen mein Herz. Es ist ein Licht, das in meinem Mund erloscht. Nachts fand ich mich auf einer Heide, starren von Unrat und Staub der Sterne. Im Haselgebüsch klangen wieder kristallne Engel.
By the late summer of 1996, the internet consummately began swinging its axe into the American Public Library System's kneecaps. And it was, then and there, at a certain public library just west of Atlanta, that I received a driver's license from the state of Georgia in exchange for six basic things. Number one, passing a sight examination. Number two, surrendering my fingerprints to the state. Number three, surrendering my likeness to the state. Number four, proving that I understood what behavior was expected of me from law enforcement officials when a traffic light shifts from red to yellow to green and back again. Number five, giving a police officer a lift to a nearby convenience store and back again. And number six, $20 American, in cash only. I was 16 years old then, and I was, and to some degree still am, a bibliophile. With that, one would surely be led to believe that I was, somehow nearly 20 years ago, among the many bookworms in the United States trapped forevermore, somewhere within the second, third, and fourth stages of grief, over the increasingly cadaverous state that the concept of a community book repository found itself approaching at that time, and fast. But I was not. I remember stuffing my freshly pressed and warm driver's license with its harshly lit and asymmetrical photograph of my typically sullen face into my cheap, artificial leather wallet, and noticing that I had still a bit of money that I could afford to burn inside, that I had earned working at a certain soulless international corporate franchise restaurant for most of that year. There was a large, dark, and lonesome room, once reserved for fossilizing microfiche readers, located just beyond the entrance to the building and to the right. The door stood open. I remember a portable black metal sign that stood about 3 feet tall, with a matching iron dome base and a piece of paper taped to it that read, "Magazines, 5 cents. Paperbacks, 10 cents. Hardcovers, 25 cents. And so, I went inside. I counted six tables there, six cheap, beige particle board tables with laminate tops and no character, all of them pushed together into the shape of a U in pairs on each of the three sides, their black vinyl edges adhered together with the petrified Bazooka Joe bubblegum of children who, I hope, managed to escape the trailer parks and the government housing projects that they were and still are in that area of the country, being herded into at a startling rate like livestock on a daily basis. And on some covert level, I am afraid, not entirely, at least without a pinch of socioeconomic and political design. Resting atop each of the six tables were groups of cardboard boxes of assorted sizes and neutral, dingy colors, all of them spilling over with ashen and omitted books for sale, having been deleted from the library's database and orphaned in order to make space for an arsenal of internet-ready desktop computers and the furniture needed to support them. The artificially intelligent saboteurs had finally arrived from IBM. I sifted through every title, panning for literary gold, and found, for the most part, nothing of much value to my admittedly and often probably too abstruse sensibilities. Presented drably there before me, I discovered right away, was little more than a dusty old buffet of banal and mostly never opened, and with good reason, Reader's Digest anthologies, and the obligatory collection of National Geographic and Popular Science magazines, with each issue still in pristine condition and sporting a cover price worth paying for. And there was a great sea of dearly departed Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedia sets going back many, many hazy decades. And there were children's books, countless children's books, adorned sweetly with crayon sketches and all of the colors made available to us from the good chemists at Crayola. Mommies and daddies, brothers and sisters, cats, dogs, and goldfish, all holding hands, paws, or fins, in polychromatic gardens with their names written backward in erratic print, inside of powder puff clouds and impossibly arching rainbows. And there were bad genre novels, as there are always bad genre novels, and they lay scattered about the room as abundant as sand and warfare is in the Sahara. Yellowed, dog-eared, and concerned most often with handsome, adventure-starving doctors, astute, mystery-seeking lawyers, bold, cigar-chewing military commanders, and with near and distant futures hinging clumsily on armchair scientific theories. Where boogeymen stumble painfully about in the shackles of their own clichés, through well-tread literary forests and dark alleys for just one more dimensionless victim. Where lonely, sexually frustrated women living in castles or on prairie land, miles and miles away from phallic-shaped fruits and vegetables, and from the warm, firm touch of a man, with envious hair, and with often an ambiguous sexual orientation. After some time, toward the end of my scavenging through these corpses made of paper, glue, cardboard, and filament, I came upon a certain large box filled formerly with Xerox brand office paper, deducible from the business logos printed on each of its four visible faces, and replaced with thin, exhausted, and disintegrating songbooks, hymnals, religious pamphlets, and a certain small pallid blue and intriguing hardcover-bound textbook, with dozens of sickly-looking threads, each the color of soured milk, exploding from the spine and every edge of it. The embossed title read simply, Deutsche Geschichte. I paid my 25 cents to a bony menopausal woman with myopia, a bad perm, and nothing to look forward to. I then put the book under my left arm, and I walked out. An hour or so later, on that hot, oppressively humid, and typically disgusting late summer day in Georgia, I drove alone, exercising this new privilege granted to me by the Department of Driver Services in a mid-1980s model red Ford Ranger pickup truck that my father purchased used with a bit of money that was allotted to me from the insurance company of a drunk driver that carved a permanent second smile into my face when I was 14 years old. My destination was a certain colossal and only possible in America multimedia retail outlet store, which was a part of a franchise established in 1992 that went bankrupt with no surprise and disappeared completely by 2006 into the bowels of Amazon.com Incorporated, along with nearly all of the other brick-and-mortar businesses of that species just a couple of years afterward. Even my own employment as something of a thankless retail drudge in such a place after 8 misspent and badly compensated years would become directly affected by that beast in 2009. And, in retrospect, it was one of the single best things that ever happened to me. Inside that certain colossal and only possible in America multimedia retail outlet store, I purchased, for $4.99, a mass-market paperback edition of a German-to-English, English-to-German dictionary published by HarperCollins, originally in, according to the copyright page, which I am looking at right now, some 17 years and a roll of duct tape later, and on another continent, August of 1991. And with the aid of that dictionary flaunting the German national colors on its cover, black, red, and gold, I attempted to translate this book that I bought for a quarter, which turned out to be titled, according to my dictionary, German Poems. That musty volume began predictably with a few selected and much too cautious for my taste works from Goethe and Schiller. The book then worked its way forward chronologically from what most literary historians recognize as the period of Weimar classicism, beginning in the late 18th century, then onto Germany's period of Romanticism with its major representative, Friedrich Holderlin. The book then went on to the Biedermeier and Vormärz periods following the Napoleonic Wars, which included certain works from the poetess Annette von Droste-Hülshoff and a pair of participants from the Junges Deutschland, or Young Germany movement, which was happening at roughly the same time. That slim volume then tread lightly through the German periods of realism and naturalism that came to an end with the turn of the 20th century to usher in the poetry of the Weimar Republic, being namely works of symbolism, expressionism, Dadaism, and Die Neue Sachlichkeit, or, in English, the New Objectivity, which ended, roughly, in 1933, along with most everything else in a creative sense, with Adolf Hitler's being grudgingly appointed Chancellor of Germany by Reichspresident Paul von Hindenburg. I remember translating each poem included in the book, word for word, with a pad and pencil, without much understanding for the German language at that time. I had no real idea or feeling for German syntax or rules of grammar. My method was simply to write each word down on a piece of notebook paper, find its English translation, or the closest thing to it, in the dictionary that I had purchased, and write it all down in sequence. Then, after reaching the end of each poem, I would collect the English words together into something akin to a cryptic tapestry of nouns and adjectives. I would then read and attempt to arrange those words with such an extreme amount of improvisation that I was undeniably approaching a level of total bastardization of the text in order to create, for myself, some sense of cohesion. And through, even in my own opinion, my less than neophyte translation of that book, I found but a very small selection of those Germanic voices entombed therein with whom I found some attraction to, based then purely on vocabulary and cadence, among them being that of repentant Nazi sympathizer, venereal disease specialist, and scribe of the Morg cycle of verse, Gottfried Benn, the highly decorated German army veteran and casualty of World War I and hand-to-hand combat in Belarus, August Strom, and the voice of a young Austrian man born here in my own current home of Salzburg in 1887, and dying just 27 years later as a lone medical attendant in the solitary service to some 90 wounded soldiers, also during World War I, in what is now Krakow, Poland, from a disputably deliberate cocaine overdose. That young man's name was Georg Trockel. Georg Trockel was born on February 3, 1887 in Salzburg, Austria, and remained there for the first 21 years of his life amongst his distant, drug-addicted Czech mother, Maria Katerina Halleck, who appears to have been more concerned with antique restoration than with the well-being of her family. Also present from the beginning of the narrative of this poet's life was his Hungarian father and hardware merchant, Tobias Trockel, three brothers, three sisters, and a French-speaking governess, Marie Boring, who worked under the Traco family's employ from roughly 1890 to 1904 and appears to have served as young Georg's earliest introduction to the world of French symbolism through the works of, most especially, Apollinaire, Baudelaire, and Rimbaud, who remain major influences on Traco for the rest of his relatively short literary life. Starting in 1892, Traco began attending a Catholic elementary school for his general education, as well as a Protestant school for his religious instruction, where he would become acquainted with his lifelong friend and promoter, Erhard Buschbeck. In 1897, Traco matriculated at the Salzburg Stadtgymnasium, where his studies were focused primarily on Latin, Greek, and mathematics. He there proved himself to be a rather inadequate student fairly early on in his life, even repeating the fourth grade in 1901. At the age of 13, Traco had already made his first attempts at writing poetry and became a member of a poetry club in Salzburg known as Apollo, and later as Minera. Then, just 2 years later, at the age of 15, Traco began drinking heavily, using opium regularly, inhaling chloroform and other substances, and frequenting nearby brothels where he would not only pay for sex, but for an audience of sympathetic prostitutes to listen to his drunken monologues and poetry recitals as well. One of these brothels, the Maison des Plaisirs in der Steingasse 24, established in the early 1600s and reputedly the oldest still standing in Austria, remains in operation to this day. I've stumbled past the brothel myself many times on my way to and from the Traco House on Vogtplatz, crossing the Staatsbrücke over the Salzach River in the Altstadt. It is generally during this time period, if not even a bit earlier, that many critics and historians believe that Traco began experiencing symptoms of a never-diagnosed form of schizophrenia that only grew stronger in time due to his erratic behavior, not only at school and elsewhere, but also within his intimate life with regard to a long-speculated and not entirely baseless belief among many biographers that he and his youngest sister, Margareta, or Gretel, as she was called within the family, were involved in an incestuous relationship for many years. All known written correspondence between Georg and his sister Gretel has been sought out and destroyed by the Traco family, presumably to conceal the details of the relationship, though it is generally understood that the two were sexually involved with one another for quite some time. Much has since been written on the subject. Much erotic symbolism has also been read into the recurring themes in Traco's poetry in reference to the object and idea of something he refers to often as the sister, among other evocative and more subtle terms. Even a marginally major motion picture titled Tabu, Es ist die Seele ein Fremdes auf Erden, directed by Christoph Stark and starring Lars Eidinger as Georg Traco and Perry Baumeister as Gretel Traco, was just produced and released from Camino Filmverleih in Stuttgart in 2011 concerning the relationship. In 1905, Traco dropped out of high school after being informed that he would be required to, once again, repeat another grade. After leaving high school, Traco enrolled in an apprenticeship program on practical pharmacology at the, ironically and portentously named in Traco's case, Weißer Engel, or the White Angel Pharmacy, also in Salzburg, probably to his own detriment as a blossoming drug addict. Traco worked at the White Angel Pharmacy for 3 years and decided to become a pharmacist by trade. During his employment there, Traco wrote and produced two plays. The first, titled Death Day, was a one-act play that premiered at the Salzburg City Theater in 1906. And the second, titled Fata Morgana, also in 1906, premiered there as well. Both plays were unsuccessful, with Fata Morgana being particularly poorly received by audiences and critics. As a result, Traco destroyed both texts. Also in 1906, Traco's prose piece titled Dream Country, an Episode, was published in the Salzburg People's Newspaper and went generally unnoticed. In 1908, Traco's first published poem, The Morning Sun, appeared in the Salzburger People's Newspaper. A few months later, he concluded his pharmacy apprenticeship and enrolled at the University of Vienna to further his education in pharmacology. It was also at this time that his sister, Gretel, went on to study piano at the Viennese Academy of Music. Though in the same city, they lived at that time separately. In 1909, Trockel assembled together what he felt were some of his better poems that he had written in his youth in an anthology that he titled himself, Collection 1909. And at the suggestion and recommendation of Erhard Buschbeck, three of Trockel's poems, Devotion, Completion, and A Passing, appeared in the New Viennese Journal that autumn. Then, beginning in the summer of 1910, Trockel's life and tone in his poetic works took a sudden turn, starting with the death of his father on June 18th of that year, which resulted in the family's financial instability from that point forward. Then, 1 month later, Georg Trockel's beloved sister, Gretel, left Vienna to continue her piano studies in Berlin, while at roughly the same time receiving his degree of Master of Pharmacy at the University of Vienna, which qualified him for active military service at the Medical Department of Vienna, a role that he took on in October of that year. In 1911, Trockel's active military service in Vienna came to an end, and he returned home to Salzburg, carrying back with him an ever-increasing depression and even stronger drug addiction. Upon returning to Salzburg, he took a proper, though short-lived, work position once again at the White Angel Pharmacy, just before being appointed as a military medical assistant, ranked second lieutenant. In March of 1912, Trockel's poem, Cheerful Spring, was published in the literary periodical Der Ruf in Vienna, co-edited by Buschbeck. A month later, Trockel began his semi-annual duties at the pharmacy of the Innsbruck Garrison Hospital. Then, in May, the poem, The Suburbs of Frauen, appeared in the highly influential bi-monthly magazine devoted to cultural criticism and the avant-garde, Der Brenner, which would also serve as a springboard for Rainer Maria Rilke and others, published by Ludwig von Ficker, who became a mentor, champion, and patron of Trockel for the rest of his short life. It was also in this year, mostly through his association with Ficker, that Trockel developed acquaintances with the likes of Oskar Kokoschka, Karl Kraus, Adolf Loos, and other contemporary artists and thinkers. His sister Gretel also married a bookseller and theater employee, Arthur Langen, in Berlin, 34 years her elder. In 1913, Trockel made an incredibly short-lived attempt at transitioning into an accounting position at the Viennese Ministry for Public Works, filing a request for dismissal after only 4 weeks of training. Soon thereafter, Trockel's deceased father's hardware store dissolved, but it was in the spring of that year that Trockel received an offer for the publication of his manuscript, Poems, from the Kurt Wolff Publishing House in Leipzig, which began distribution of the book in July. Afterward, Trockel traveled to Venice with Ficker, Kraus, and Loos, and he gave his only public reading of the work in December of that year during an evening presentation by Der Brenner writers in Innsbruck. In 1914, Trockel's manuscript, Sebastian in Dream, was sent to the Kurt Wolff Publishing House just before his traveling to Berlin to comfort his sister Gretel in the aftermath of an abortion. It would be the last time that he would ever see her. On August 24th, Georg Trockel was called in for active military service in the Austrian army with the outbreak of World War I. 1 month later, he attempted to commit suicide in Poland during the Battle of Grodek with a handgun after suffering a nervous breakdown while single-handedly caring for nearly 100 seriously wounded soldiers in the battlefield. Trockel's suicide attempt was prevented by the physical intervention of some of his comrades. As a result of his attempted suicide, Trockel was taken to a military hospital in Krakow for mental observation to determine his fitness for continued duty. While in hospital, Ficker visited Trockel. He was the last of Georg's friends to see him alive. A little more than a week later, none other than famed Austrian-British philosopher and noted philanthropist for the arts, Ludwig Wittgenstein, traveled to Krakow to visit Trockel himself, donating some 20,000 Austrian-Hungarian crown to aid in the support of Trockel in his work, which was being held in good faith in Innsbruck by Ficker during Trockel's service in the war, but Wittgenstein arrived too late. Georg Trockel was pronounced dead at 9 p.m. on November 3, 1914, in Krakow at the Military Garrison Hospital from heart failure as a result of an overdose of cocaine. His body was buried 3 days later at the Rakovicer Cemetery in Krakow and relocated on October 7, 1925 to the city of Mulau near Innsbruck, where a proper funeral was held and arranged by Ficker with friends, family, and admirers in attendance. Georg Trockel's remains lie there to this day in repose next to Ficker's. Trockel's final poems were published posthumously in Der Brenner the year after his death, along with the book Sebastian and Dream. In a letter written to Ludwig von Ficker just before his death, Trockel asked that all of his possessions, including the 20,000 crown from Wittgenstein, be given to his sister Gretel in the possible event of his demise during his service at war. And even with this newfound, even if modest amount of financial support, Gretel could not manage to resuscitate her failed career as a professional pianist, derailed by her marriage, a rumored affair with Buschbeck, abortion, and drug abuse. Her husband soon left her, and she, like her brother Georg, descended into a life governed by various drug addictions and psychoses. Then, finally, on September 23, 1917, just 3 years after her brother's death, Margarete Trockel committed suicide with a handgun after a party in Berlin. In 1919, the Kurt Wolff Publishing House published the first complete edition of Trockel's collected poetry, edited by Karl Ruck. In 1939, Erhard Buschbeck published Trockel's poems of youth under the title From the Golden Chalice through the Otto Müller Publishing House in Salzburg. And then, in the 1950s, something of a rediscovery of Trockel's work, along with many other seemingly lost German-language creative voices of the Expressionist period during what was, more or less, the first half of the 20th century, took place in many German and English literary circles. So, here we are now in the 21st century, and the name Georg Trockel doesn't roll often off of the tongue of most people in the English-speaking world, or the German-speaking one, for that matter, really, anymore, except in relation to many very broad and mostly, I find, superficial examinations of German Expressionism, where most everything, outside of the immeasurably influential film catalogs of the early titans of cinema, Fritz Lang, F.W. Murnau, and Robert Wiene, is more often than not whittled down to a little more than a footnote, or at most an anecdote, in most recent publications on the subject. And this is understandably so, I believe. Anything trapped in even the most remote association of those beautiful, impossibly long and mysterious shadows of German Expressionist cinema has almost no room to breathe and no light to show its face in, and that shadow has been cast heavily over the prose, the theater, and most especially, I think, the poetry of that most unusual and probably, thankfully, brief period of rather uniquely European and uniquely German language-speaking history. I feel that in Trockel's work we have a poetry that isn't bound in any way to any timely matters of politics, fashion, or to a certain ideal. Even in labeling him as an expressionist and hanging all of the baggage around his neck that goes along with that term seems to me an evil only necessary in marketing terms for publishing houses, for Trockel seems to me to be not entirely bound to that aesthetic. I find that the characteristic darkness that comes along with that loaded term of expressionism is not the type of often too intentional darkness that I find in Trockel. There is something all too natural and incredibly simple that I read into Trockel's work that I don't feel from the career intellectuals and pampered progeny that his name is usually associated with, an association by chronology and geography and not necessarily by creative kinship. Trockel's language is simple, even in its original German, and I feel that there is a reason for it. I believe that Trockel was attempting to paint his poetic works with intentionally broad strokes in an effort to allow for his audience's own imaginations to be able to breathe in his world, to be able to fill in the many purposefully unacknowledgeable details so that the reader may participate in some way, using Trockel's often incredibly short and vague verbal suggestions of place and tone as a catalyst for the reader's own inner theater. For example, there is a line from the poem, A Spring Evening, that reads,
"Beautiful things float in a tranquil wind from here to nowhere."
What are these beautiful things? Where is here? Where are they going? It's all up to us to decide. Also, found often in Trockel's work are these, I find to be, sublimely beautiful passages that read like dreams better told with whispers, such as this from his poem, Age, that reads,
"Very far away, an old fountain sings, with children's voices, I listen there."
Trockel is also capable of some searing moments of critical symbolism as well, even if not always entirely mature. For example, from the poem titled At the Moor, Trockel bemoans, like the young person that he was, even if eloquently,
"The way home is shrouded by the tender sadness of the grazing herd."
And there are also some moments to be found, I think, in Trockel's work that are, for me at least, like these delicate little moments of beautifully articulated lyrical ambiguity that have probably influenced my own work as a songwriter over the years. Some such moments can be found in brief passages such as this one, from what is perhaps Trockel's best-known poem, whatever that might mean, from De Profundis, that reads,
"On my forehead, cold metal forms, and spiders look for my heart. There is a light that fails in my mouth."
Today, Georg Trockel's birthplace on the Vogtplatz, found near the south bank of the Zalzach River, a few steps east from the Staatsbrücke in the Altstadt, still stands in Salzburg, where it is known simply as the Trockel House, or in English, as the Georg Trockel Memorial Center. It stands open to the public and features a permanent collection of handwritten documents from the poet, original publications, family furnishings, a personal photo archive, and a regularly changing art gallery featuring work from contemporary artists, usually with no association with Trockel whatsoever. Also scattered throughout the city is a series of tastefully presented and fittingly unassuming bronze plates with poems from Trockel engraved into them that illustrate their position in the city from his perspective. One can be found, naturally, in the Vogtplatz featuring the poem Die Schöne Stadt, or The Beautiful City, obviously a reference to Salzburg. Another plate can be found in St. Peter's Cemetery, a place which served as a clear influence on Sebastian in Dream. Another plate can be found above St. Peter's Abbey on Munksberg Mountain, a location which I frequent myself, which features the poem Am Munksberg. There is also a plate featuring the poem Musik im Mirabell, fixed on the eastern wall of the beautiful Mirabell Gardens. Another one of my own personal favorite spots in Salzburg. I go there often to listen to some of the many incredibly talented street musicians that perform there every day. Another plate is located at the Engel Apotheke, formerly the Weißer Engel, or the White Angel, where Trockel took up his apprenticeship and later worked as a pharmacist in the Linzergasse 5. That plate features the poem, fittingly from the time that he worked there, Im Dunkel. Three other plates can be found throughout the city and in neighboring Hellbrunn. If you are interested in seeing directly the inspiration behind some of Trockel's work, I believe that each of the plates are worth seeking out. Trockel saw very little of his own work published within his lifetime, including only Gedichte from 1913. His pieces in Der Brenner and other associated newspapers and literary journals. But a rather extensive bibliography of his work in mostly German and English has been amassed since his death. A bibliography that is, I feel, too vast to be discussed here within the confines of this program. Regardless, most of Trockel's work is available online, free of charge and legally, at Gutenberg.org, in its original German. Complete English translations of Trockel's work, most notably, I feel, by James Wright, Robert Bly, Daniel Simcoe, and a few others, are also easily obtainable from all major book retailers.
In Venice. Silence in the rented room. The candlestick flickers with silver light before the singing breath of the lonely man, enchanted rose cloud. Black swarms of flies darken the stony space, and the head of the man who has no home is numb from the agony of the golden day. The motionless sea grows dark, stars black and voyages on the canal. Child, your sickly smile followed me softly in my sleep.
You have been listening to a Tephra Media production of Subjected. Copyright 2013 by Justin Kerfman and Tephra Media Publishing. All rights reserved. You may subscribe to this program and obtain transcripts at justinkerfman.com.